provocative. I would like to add, before turning the podium over to Professor Jaffa, the fact that I think it's not only for myself the clarity of his mind that I admire, but indeed the fact that he comes equipped with one particular talent which is, I think, essential to the social philosopher. I do not think there is anyone in the United States that is his superior in terms of being able to practice the art of exegesis, the art of close textual analysis. By the same token, Professor Jaffa has also the ability to conceptually grasp the full dimensions of the philosophical problem. And this is a rare, unique, but altogether necessary talent for the practice of social thought. And I'm sure that this particular flair, for which he is, I think, most justifiably renowned, will be displayed in his remarks on the question of presidential power. Thank you. Make my task more difficult than it ought to be by such a flattering introduction. Well, as I listened to Professor Witanski, I was listening carefully to try to find something that I could comment on adversely. It was rather difficult, but I picked up a couple of points. If I understood you correctly, you said that, referred to Andrew Jackson's hatred or animosity towards the Eastern liberal establishment. Was that correct?
No. Specifically against the Eastern establishment. I mean, the term liberal would not have been the term.
Oh, yes.
One might have used the term like logophogo, and of course his animosity wasn't totally against the logophogos, it was really against people like Biddle, for example.
Yes. Well, I wanted to just make a comment on that. I think that the main purport of the remark is correct, but it wasn't, I think, the Eastern establishment, but the Philadelphia establishment, because Jacksonian democracy was founded upon a firm alliance between Jackson's Southwest and New York.
Quite, yes.
And if the war on the Bank of the United States had any durable and concrete result, it was the transference of the financial center of the East from Philadelphia to Wall Street. And so Andrew Jackson's warfare against the East resulted in the victory of Wall Street over Chestnut Street. And since his heir and successor was Martin Van Buren, its antagonism to the East as such is, I think, at best equivocal or ambivalent.
No, I think that if I can say something now, Professor Lee Benson, whose work you know, I think is very solidly demonstrated, quantitatively at least, that he had great support in the Northeast. And indeed, you are right. And when I speak of the Eastern establishment was then the sort of Biddle Philadelphia Bank of the United States establishment.
And a good deal of the strict constructionism of the of Jacksonian dogma was less, I think, an indication of any general constitutional principle than it reflected the fact that the Erie Canal had been built with the capital subscribed largely through the New York banks. And the New Yorkers didn't want to help finance any opposition to the Erie Canal to the central government. However, I don't think that the principle of strict construction in Jacksonian democracy had much more general bearing than the exigencies of New York in its particularly in the struggle between, as I said, Nicholas Biddle and the interest represented by Van Buren. But I just mentioned that sort of in passing. Another durable result of the of Jackson's war against the Eastern establishment was the more or less permanent submersion of John C. Calhoun in the game of presidential politics. Van Buren, who was in many respects certainly not a man of the stature of Calhoun, but he did practice the art of politics in a way which was fundamentally superior to Calhoun. One other point that I would take exception to, you said that if Andrew Johnson had been impeached, you didn't think that the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt would have been possible. Is that correct?
Yes, I was emulating Henri Perrin in making that kind of a statement, his Mohammed and Charlemagne thing. Uh-huh. I do feel very strongly that during the period after the Civil War, when of course we have a very strong and dominant Congress, Republican Congress, had they succeeded in doing that, I'm quite convinced, and of course one must also recall that party organization was much stronger, was a very dominant force, was the dominant force in political activity up until Woodrow Wilson, that party supremacy would have remained at least well into the 20th century. It's hard to, one of these must-have theories or might-have-been theories, and I'm quite convinced that the party, dominated by Congress, would have become more of a series of parliamentarian parties, and that the idea of strong presidents would have been quite unlikely. What we would have had would have been presidents chosen by Congress, probably cronies, and dominated by Congress. And how long this would have lasted, well, it's hard to say, but certainly there's every reason to believe that it might well have lasted into the 30s.
Well,
I think the idea of a governor becoming, like Franklin Roosevelt, becoming a president would have been most unlikely in a system of government like that.
Let me just comment briefly. My opinion, I think, differs from yours, although I don't think that either one of us can demonstrate what would have happened if something else had happened. I think that if a president had been successfully impeached, that would have created a precedent which still does not exist, which would have influenced subsequent presidents, perhaps somewhat more, in their reflections on the constitutionality of their actions. I think the impeachment power has always played a very important role in the minds of presidents when considering whether or not something they are doing might not constitute grounds for impeachment. Certainly Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1940 and 41 thought a great deal about it when he was engaging in certain initiatives in foreign policy which were of doubtful legality, even in his own mind. The trading of destroyers, overage destroyers for bases was one, the shoot on sight orders in the North Atlantic was another, and several other points. On the other hand, he was also, of course, not sure which way the war in Europe was going to go, and hence whether or not his actions would appear to have been actions in a losing and hence bad cause. However, I don't really think that the Franklin D. Roosevelt of the 100 days would have been, that which was really the beginning of the strong presidency of the second Roosevelt, would have been influenced by such a precedent, because I think there was general consent in the country at that time for a very strong executive leadership, and the Congress, after all, responded by passing a great many laws, some of which the members hadn't even read, and some of which, in fact, weren't even printed before they were passed. But that, I think, was a response to a crisis which the country perceived as calling for very strong executive leadership. I think the best books written on the 100 days and, in fact, the first 2 years of the Roosevelt presidency are by Ray Moley. Ray Moley, as you know, I'm not sure whether he's a member of the Philadelphia Society at this time. I'm sure he has been. He became a strong antagonist, perhaps the most powerful and relentless antagonist among the really good writers on the Roosevelt years. But, of course, he was a strong believer in the 100 days and in the first 2 years. The policies of the Roosevelt administration were very largely his policies at that time, which perhaps may explain his affection for them. Believed that Roosevelt had succeeded in, by really drastically cutting government expenses, as he promised he would, and he did in his first budget, by his action in both closing and reopening the banks and restoring that minimum confidence, which threatened to destroy the fabric of American society. The threat to, you might say, to the essential middle class nature of American democracy in 1933 was not altogether different from, in its impact, what the inflation had done to the German middle class in the early 20s. It was not the same phenomenon, but the threat of social disintegration and the demand for some form of radical change in our fundamental institutions was very powerful at the time. And one should never forget that Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany the same month that Franklin D. Roosevelt became President of the United States, and that the demands for the same kind of leadership were very strong here as well as there. And while the Roosevelt presidency during those years has been called, and is like the title of the book by the late Clinton Russell, Constitutional Dictatorship, there was an element of dictatorship, but one should always emphasize the word constitutional along with it. Remembering, as I do rather vividly, since I was a high school student by those years at that time, and not as interested in political things then as I am now, remembering the crisis of March 1933 and the demands for some form of leadership that would at least create the illusion that we knew where we were going, I can't believe what happened in the Andrew Johnson presidency would have made any real difference to the way Roosevelt acted then. Well, that's just a historical by the way. I think that one could full. There is a crisis of the presidency today. I am much more concerned about the possible loss in the prestige and power of leadership of the presidency than I am in any possible excesses of presidential power, however important I think it is that power in our society should always be circumscribed and defined by law. I do think, however, that there is a dimension of the presidency which can never be fully circumscribed by law, for reasons which I think one could as well find in the chapter on prerogative in Locke's Second Treatise of Civil Government as anywhere else. And although Locke was writing about a monarch, he was writing about a constitutional monarch, who is, in this respect, I think, is not different from a president. Every society, Locke's main point is that every society must have within it some lawful power for dealing with unforeseen contingencies, which contingencies, since they do exist an element of the dimension of political reality, cannot be defined in advance, and yet there must be a lawful power for dealing with these. The power to do things which are unprecedented and undefined and, in a sense, unauthorized is a power which cannot be used simply invented at the convenience of a president. Things become lawful by becoming necessary in a way which I think probably cannot be defined better than that in advance of the particular occasion. Let me give a couple of examples from American history. Jefferson's purchase of Louisiana was one of the two great exercises of presidential power in the 19th century, which transformed the nature of American institutions. The other one, will come to no one's surprise, is of course the Emancipation Proclamation. Let's consider both of those just for a moment. You all know, at least I'm sure, the rudiments of the outline of the story of the Louisiana Purchase. I don't remember it probably any better than any of you here at the moment. We know that as a result of the war between France and England, Napoleon found himself in a position in which his French, on the one hand, the French Empire in the New World was no longer defensible by French power, as a matter of fact, his title for Louisiana was very imperfect and probably belonged to Spain, but unfortunately for Spain, he was the master of Spain at the time, or at least of its foreign policy, and therefore his claim to the retrocession of Louisiana from France to Spain was the effective one, and he was willing to sell for a good, what from his point of view was a good price, something which he wasn't sure he owned anyway, and which he couldn't defend very effectively, at least without a sacrifice of other objectives which to him were of a higher priority at the time. So contrary to all reasonable expectations, as they then seemed, of American diplomacy, the United States had the opportunity of picking up a rather defective title to approximately one-third of the North American continent. It was a defective title which would, of course, become effective because it was altogether probable that the United States in possession would be impossible to dislodge by any European power, at least until it had won the war in Europe. So Jefferson had the opportunity to buy Louisiana. Jefferson himself found nothing in the Constitution to warrant such an executive action, but he knew that the moment might easily pass, and before the matter could be put before the Congress, he had to give the necessary instructions, and of course he went ahead and did it on the assumption that he was benefiting the United States and that he would allow this action of his, which he was sure was extra-constitutional, to be ratified by Congress and by subsequent American elections. The purchase of Louisiana didn't simply mean getting something from France or getting a good bargain. It involved all kinds of tremendous constitutional problems. Louisiana was not vacant territory, and it wasn't inhabited only by Indians. There was a population in the New Orleans area greater than that of several of the existing states of the Union. Jefferson not only bought Louisiana, he gave United States citizenship, or gave a commitment of American citizenship to what was in effect a foreign nation. There have been various proposals in the past few years to make both South Vietnam and Israel states of the American Union. I don't have to indicate that the enormous complications that such suggestions make even for theoretical discussion, which I'm only raising them here as for purposes of theory. But that's what Jefferson did, and the Congress had to make good his commitment. And the purchase of Louisiana was not something regarded as unequivocally benevolent from the point of view of the United States as a whole. The threatened secession of New England culminated in the Hartford Convention had its beginnings with the purchase of Louisiana, because the New England Federalists instantly saw Louisiana as a source of a whole series of new states, beginning with Louisiana, which was really promised statehood by statehood full citizenship, which meant statehood by Jefferson, and that meant the permanent submersion of the Northeast in a union which would be now dominated by the South and Southwest. And so the first great secession movement in American history had its genesis in the Louisiana Purchase. And by the way, it turned the Federalists from being the liberal constructionists to being strict constructionists. And oddly enough, John C. Calhoun learned the doctrine of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions and the religion of strict constructionism by going to Yale College, where the New England Federalists, who had become Jeffersonians to be anti-Jefferson, held sway. Well, I mentioned this is an example of presidential prerogative, which I think is a necessary conception of the office of chief of executive in any system of government, not merely in a constitutional democracy, but a democracy like ours, I think must always find a place for it, and that I think is the real root of those extensions of presidential power in times of crisis, usually, although not inevitably or invariably, involving foreign affairs. The reason for, I think, the weak presidency in the post-Civil War period was not simply the growth of the party system or the predominance of the radical Republicans in the immediate post-war period. I think it was the most durable underlying reason was simply the fact that the kind of problems that the United States faced simply did not call for the kind of executive leadership which usually does develop in a period when foreign affairs or some grave constitutional crisis usually involving foreign affairs is the major source of political activity. I mean, the Civil War, the victory of the Union in the Civil War solved the major internal, removed the major barriers to the rapid development of the nation, the building of the railroad system, which was stymied by the conflict between the sections, the question of banking, tariffs, internal improvements. There was a general demand for internal improvements, which simply broke down time and again because of the North-South conflict, which prevented any kind of reasonable compromise of the use of federal funds for purposes of internal improvements. With the ending of that obstacle, there really was a general consensus on the direction that the internal development of the country should take in the next generation. One of the most constructive, interestingly enough, if you look at the history of important domestic legislation in the United States, you find out that one of the most constructive periods, or at least one of the most periods of great development and change, was the Civil War itself. During Lincoln's presidency, most of the great new legislative programs which were to dominate the domestic scene for the next generation or even two generations were passed. Lincoln himself had almost nothing to do with them except sign them into law. He was almost completely absorbed by the war itself, which dominated every minute of every hour of every day for him. But the old Whig programs, which both John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay in different ways and at different times had advocated, and which had been tried, by the way, during the presidency of Harrison. Harrison's election of a Whig president in Congress in 1840 was supposed to lay the foundation for a real program of what we might better recognize as Hamiltonian internal improvements in tariff and banking legislation. But the death of Harrison and the unexpected elevation of a Southern, really conservative Democrat to the presidency on the Whig platform led to the a conflict between president and Congress, which kept that program ever from being enacted, and the fundamental split in the party system prevented the Whigs from ever having the victory in Congress and the presidency together that their election of two presidents seemed to suggest. But under Lincoln, all of these things, which he himself had supported mainly as a Whig congressman and as a Whig during all the years he was a follower of Henry Clay, they were passed into law. And the solution of the problem of slavery in the Union really left no field for the kind of of executive leadership that crises produce. And the Congress was not so much a powerful Congress as it was a scene in which the interests who had, who had won their victory in the Civil War took advantage of their position. And there was very little in either the theory or practice of a strong presidency until, Cleveland was laid some foundations for that, but not only Woodrow Wilson, but one must remember Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt, who was a great disciple of Alexander Hamilton, and wrote a good deal about the subject of executive prerogative. His remarks about the presidency being a bully pulpit also had their extension in an idea of executive power, which he himself really never implemented because he wasn't faced with the kind of crises that called for the kind of strong president that he would have liked to have been if only he could have been president during wartime, which he would have loved, of course. I mention this to suggest that John Ehrlichman's remark was, of course, a very foolish and, I must say, a very stupid remark to make. But it was a foolish and stupid remark to make because anyone who understood why what he said was, in some important sense, true would have had enough sense to know not to say it, you see. There's some things that the truth of which can only be perceived. Those who understand them simply understand why one ever says such things. I mean, it's all very well and good for Jefferson to go to the country and say, I had to purchase Louisiana. But for John Ehrlichman to stand up and say anything the president wants to do if he thinks it's in the national security is constitutional is a very stupid thing to say. But one should understand that its stupidity is not measured by its truthfulness. A president can say that if he discovers some tremendous threat to the national security, which he can then convey convincingly to the American people and then say, that's what the danger is and this is what I must do. But for the assistant to the president to say that any violation of law or something that appears palpably to be a violation of law, whether it was or not, because I wouldn't want to make a final judgment on that because I, and as far as I know, no one in this room knows what the facts were. Sometimes a president might really think that something is necessary, which he finds out afterwards, and finding out afterwards that it wasn't necessary, realizes it's illegal, and which, because he realizes it's illegal, he must perforce, if he has any sense, disavow. But of course, his ability to disavow something depends upon the extent to which he has been a convincing national leader in whom the people have a fundamental trust. Let me make just a brief remark about the Emancipation Proclamation. Here, perhaps, I might introduce my remark about the Emancipation Proclamation by a story, I suppose by now everybody has his Richard Nixon story, and I have mine. In 1965, I was invited by the Los Angeles Lincoln Club to give one of their annual Lincoln Day speeches. And I say one of them because it's the custom of the Lincoln Club of Los Angeles to have two speakers, one of whom is classified roughly as academic, and the other is political. And I qualified, of course, as an academic speaker. The other speaker happened to be Richard Nixon. And it was a very, I had no, when I went there, I knew he was going to be the other speaker. I had no idea that there was anything required of me, at least, except to speak. But lo and behold, they had a reception line before the dinner. And I don't know how many people attended the dinner. My estimate is the audience was somewhere between 700 and 800. It was the large banquet hall of the California Club, and it was filled. Well, I perceived, or at least perceived in retrospect, that almost all of the guests were people who had been political supporters of Richard Nixon, probably from the earliest days of his career. And, of course, and he greeted them, every one of them. But that was perfectly all right. That was his business, not mine. But unfortunately, they stuck me right alongside of them, and so I had to shake hands with every damn one of them, too. But it afforded me a very interesting insight into Mr. Nixon, although an insight which attained significance in my mind only some time after the event itself. But still, I do retain a very keen memory of that occasion, because he greeted each person by name. He had nobody with him. If there was some electronic device inside his ear or something which was advising him, I couldn't see it, and I don't really believe that it was there. But he knew everybody, and as far as I could tell, greeted everybody by name. Some of the people may have spoken their names to him as he stepped forward to greet them, that's possible, but as far as I could tell, he just greeted everybody by name, and he had a personal remark to make to each one. Each one had some remark made either about his waistline, his hairline, his golf game, his family, but it was a personal remark. And when Nixon shook hands with each one, he looked straight into their eyes, and for one split moment, that person had the absolutely undivided personal attention of Richard M. Nixon. And then he turned and with absolute courtesy introduced this person who was obviously one of his oldest and dearest friends to me, who had obviously become one of his newest, if not dearest friends. But the warmth of the manner didn't betray any discrimination of any kind, either between the one who came before or the one who came after in the line. The 500 or 600 person got exactly the same greeting as the 77th or the 78th. And I got introduced with exactly the same amount of warmth and courtesy. It was a remarkable display of political professionalism. Oh, I should add also, not only did he do this, but he moved that line along with unbelievable speed, you see. I mean, it was an assembly line, each unit of which was perfectly individualized, you know, like when you order your Impala or something, you can get to just the right. It's all machine gunning with computers, and yet it comes out with just the shade of chartreuse that you want and the upholstery that you want. And so Richard Dixon succeeded in giving an absolutely individualized greeting to each one in that line, and he moved them along. The subject of my lecture that evening was reflections on the assassinations of presidents. The Kennedy assassination was still rather green in our memory, and I tried to explain why, in my opinion, the death of President Kennedy was, while a terrible misfortune and what might be called a tragedy in the ordinary, everyday common sense of the term, was not a tragedy in a specific sense. It was a senseless act of violence, which was a great misfortune. But the death of Lincoln was a tragedy, I thought, in a very precise poetic sense of the term. There was something of the tragedy of great poetic tragedy in Lincoln's death, because the Civil War itself was a tragedy. And Lincoln had become the central figure, the sort of heroic figure who, in his life and in his death, symbolized the catastrophe which had come upon the nation. In speaking of the Emancipation Proclamation, then, I pointed out that this, while representing, in a way, the culmination of Lincoln's own convictions, as he said, all men everywhere might be free, was about the worst way in which emancipation could have happened. And I pointed the difference between Lincoln's own desire for compensated emancipation by constitutional amendment and by law rather than by military decree, and that Lincoln, of course, the Emancipation Proclamation was looked at on the surface was a violation of the promise that he himself had made in his first inaugural address that he would do nothing to interfere with slavery in the states, but that, of course, the war had changed all that, and he felt obliged as commander-in-chief to strike at the property of the enemy as contraband. That, on the other hand, the emancipation presented the paradox that Lincoln only declared slaves free behind the enemy lines where he couldn't reach, where his own power did not reach, while exempting from the proclamation those states and those states which had, slave states which had remained loyal, and those parts of the disloyal slave states which had been reconquered by the Union. And I elaborated on all of these paradoxes of the Emancipation Proclamation, but of the war and of Lincoln's presidency altogether, and the sense in which the war was a catastrophe, because really, from Lincoln's point of view, the founding, the original Constitution itself, had certain fatal self-contradictions in it. By the original Constitution, Negroes were regarded both as property and as persons endowed with rights, and the one thing contradicted the other. And that contradiction became, in time, a contradiction which was fatal to the Union as it had been in its original form, and that Lincoln's attempts to preserve the Union as it had been proved impossible, and he himself was driven by a kind of tragic necessity to take actions which destroyed the Union which he had set out to preserve, and which led him himself to speak of a new birth of freedom, which meant, of course, a new Union and a new Constitution as well. Well, Mr. Nixon, after having introduced me about 600 times, I couldn't find it in him to say a word to me about my lecture. And as far as I could tell, he didn't listen to it, and he had no interest in the subject at all. I can't say that's true, because we didn't exchange any comments which would enable me to confirm a hypothesis one way or the other. But I think that Nixon's presidency has itself, in its own way, proved to be a tragedy. A tragedy because Mr. Nixon was, I think, in a very important way, a very serviceable instrument for the pursuit of policies which perhaps may not deserve to be or shouldn't be called conservative in any ideological sense, but which were, I think, soundly within the spectrum of policies which people calling themselves conservatives could support. The liquidation in the war in Vietnam without absolutely cutting and running, and without American servicemen coming home on their knees, but on their feet, was, I think, in fact, an honorable end to the war there. Not to each one of us the satisfaction of anyone, but it was one that I think that one could reasonably support. There was no knuckling under the communist power. I think that the deplorable decline of the American defense establishment begun under the McNamara Defense Administration continued under Mr. Nixon. I think I had the belief that he was doing what he could to reverse it, not as successfully as I would have liked, but at least not in a he was not endorsing that decline. The SALT talk, I thought, was in some ways registered the misfortunes of bad policies of previous years. I don't think that it accelerated that decline. Perhaps Steve Pisani would differ with that. I didn't like it, but somehow I believed that Mr. Nixon was buying time to strengthen our defense, so, and would, if he could get the necessary support in Congress. The welfare state was not being liquidated by Mr. Nixon, and couldn't be, and I'm not so sure that it should be. Some attempt was made, I think, through the idea of revenue sharing to begin at least the process of decentralization, a process of moving the main focus of government from Washington out of Washington. It was not a revolutionary conservative movement, but at least it seemed to mark a direction which I think most of us welcomed. And if it didn't go fast enough, far enough, at least it was moving in the right direction. And then came this kind of curse upon us called Watergate, which seems to have put a complete stop almost to any systematic presidential leadership in the direction of a generally reduced federal bureaucracy, a general movement from a government-directed and controlled economy to a market economy, a general movement towards the strengthening of our strategic posture, and some reduction in America's commitments to the world, but one which seems to have been required by many developments. The initiatives of Secretary Kissinger in relationship to China and Russia seemed to me, even though they were interpreted very differently by the liberal media, seemed to me to a recognition that the conflict between Russia and China was one which the United States could needed to manage, simply to prevent a world war starting between a war between the communist powers, but one which also provided some leverage for the United States in the protection of its vital interests through the exploitation of this conflict in a prudent way, and one which would allow diplomacy to act at the margins of military power in a constructive and intelligent way. I think that under Melvin Laird's administration, the Defense Department was moving to play an intelligent role within the framework of this new and revised foreign policy. But all of this depends and depended upon the basic integrity of the presidency as that bully pulpit in which presidents could speak as the moral leaders and hence the people who, the one institution and agency in American government which could mobilize national opinion behind national goals in those areas in which the mobilization of such opinion for such goals was reasonable and proper. But that, I think, has been rendered extraordinarily difficult now. Perhaps it is even the great purposes which I have mentioned have been now even made impossible in a certain way by this Watergate phenomenon, which has produced a crisis of confidence which seems almost wanton it seems to be a senseless act, like Kennedy's assassination, a kind of intervention from outside. But it is not an intervention from outside. I believe there was a flaw in Mr. Nixon, a failure on his part to understand that as a representative of Middle America, he had to at least preserve the illusion of an integrity, which was not the integrity of George Washington or Abraham Lincoln, but at least one which he could appear at least as the custodian of that kind of morality which has been identified with the great presidents and with the Constitution itself. Well, there wouldn't be time for me to even begin to reflect on the nature of that flaw, other than to point out that it exists, and the sense in which I think there is no greater danger to America's future today than the decline in the confidence of the presidency because I believe that whether we like or dislike the particular policies of Franklin D. Roosevelt or Harry Truman or Dwight Eisenhower or John F. Kennedy, the presidential prerogative, both in its traditional constitutional implications and in its occasional ventures onto the margins of legality in the service of the nation in moments which are moments of crisis, is an essential part of the tribunate of the American presidency, in which the people have in the past and must always, when they are faced with great danger, seek safety in the future. Thank you.